This is an interview with Dr. Andrew Draper, class of 1938. We're in Ocala, Florida. Dr. Draper, it's very good to meet you. I'll call you Andy, as you asked, and you call me Don.
Thank you, Don.
And we're here to talk about your life growing up and how you got to Cornell and your life as a veterinarian. You were born in New Jersey, you told me.
West New York, New Jersey.
Which doesn't exist now.
It doesn't exist now. It's part of Jersey City. And anytime I used to go to Canada quite a bit, and it always confused the officers at the border that I would say West New York. And they didn't know whether I was talking about New York State or New Jersey.
Your parents grew up in New Jersey?
My father grew up in Southport, England, and my mother in Edinburgh, Scotland. They moved to this country in, I think, the 80s.
And they settled in New Jersey?
They settled in Yonkers, New York. And then Dad took an engineering course in some school in New Jersey. I don't know which one it was. And that's why they moved. And his father moved to New Jersey, too. His father was a stair builder. And I well recall his home with the stable downstairs and the horse. No such thing as a car.
But you grew up in Connecticut?
Yes, in Fairfield, Connecticut.
And how did you develop an interest in animals?
I lived close to a farm. It was a big estate, actually, and they had a lot of cows and horses, draft horses. That's where I got my first job of walking out stalls. Eventually, I was milking the cows, and I kept that job until I was in about my first year at Cornell.
How old were you when you started working with the cattle? These were dairy cattle, were they?
Dairy cattle. Mostly Guernseys, as I recall. I was probably 11 or 12 when I started working with them.
Do you recall where the milk was sent? Was it sent to one of the big dairies in New York City?
No. It was delivered by I can't remember the man's name, but all the milk was bottled right where we milked, and he delivered it by a car. I can't remember what kind of a car. It must have been a Maxwell or something like that.
And this was before pasteurization?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was delivered locally.
Mm-hmm. Your parents must have been interested in higher education for you and your sister, because both of you got a university education.
Yes, they were. And as Dad always said, I'm going to leave everything to Mary because I can't give her the education I have given you. And she went to the Presbyterian Hospital in New York City for 4 years and became a registered nurse.
Now, she's 5 years younger than you and
she's
living...
She's 4 years younger than I am.
Living in Connecticut?
Mm-hmm. She lives still in Connecticut. She's 92 now.
Could you tell me about your high school? And after your high school, you went to another school before you went to Cornell.
I went to Roger Ludlow High School in Fairfield. There wasn't any such thing as a school bus then. We walked about a mile to the trolley, and the trolley took us to the center of Fairfield, and we had about another half-mile walk to school. Then we moved when I was a sophomore, a little closer to school, and I used to walk to school about a mile and a half. High school was from 9 in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon, and my father insisted that I take a science course, which I did, and I graduated in 31. And then I went to the Junior College of Connecticut in Bridgeport, which was right next to Fairfield, just a short bus ride. And I graduated in 33 from junior college, and I went back I graduated in 32 and I went back in 33 to get some courses to allow me to enter veterinary school.
You had an interview. Could you tell me about that, please?
I wrote to Cornell to ask about veterinary school, and they told me I didn't have enough credits for the class of 38. Sent me back to junior college, and I took another year of study. Chemistry and botany were two of the subjects they wanted. And then that spring, they wrote me again after I sent them my marks, and had me go to Waterbury, Connecticut, which was 30 or 40 miles away, and meet Dr. A.T. Gilliard. Which I did, and we had a very nice interview or meeting, and I think thanks to him I probably gained entrance to vet school.
You got to know him later in your career very well.
I knew him most of my career because we only lived 30 or 40 miles apart. Once I came back to Fairfield in 1940, I saw him quite frequently.
Mm-hmm. And he had a son?
And he had a son, Richard, and I knew Dick very well. He graduated in 35, and I used to go in the summertime and work with him quite a bit, vaccinating hogs, I remember, in the garbage fields.
This was before you graduated?
Before I graduated. So I had a good idea what I was getting into. But I was interested in all of that, especially cattle.
What would you have done if you had not become a veterinarian?
Well, I was on my way to become a structural engineer. That's what I was studying. I don't know whether I would have made it or not. I didn't like being indoors all the time. I didn't like sitting in an office. Little did I know I would eventually.
But you met a physician along the way?
Yes, our family doctor was the one who said to me, why don't you look into veterinary medicine? Because you've been working on Lasher's farm all these years, and you like cows, and you know quite a bit about cows. And that's how it started.
So you entered in the fall of 1934.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if my records are correct, there were 43 of you in that class that started together. Of the 43, only 29 of you graduated at the end of the 4 years.
Yeah, I remember 28.
I may be wrong. But still, there was quite a number of people that didn't carry forward. Did they talk to you about what your chance of success would be when you started?
No, I don't recall.
How did you travel to Ithaca? By train, by car?
By train and car.
By train and car.
Lehigh Valley train to, Hoboken, New Jersey, I think. And then we took the tunnel across to Grand Central Station. And then on New York, New Haven and Hartford to Fairfield, Connecticut. It was an hour's ride.
Had you ever been that far west? To Ithaca, that far north previously?
No.
What was your impression as a young man going away to college?
I loved it. I thought it was great. Mm-hmm. And I remember staying on, Lisdon Avenue or Lisdon Street.
Did you have a house there? You were boarding
house?
No,
I had a room.
A room in a house?
In a house,
mm-hmm.
And I couldn't afford to go live in one of the dormitories.
Mm-hmm. Did you work as you were going through college?
Yes, I did. Oh, not in... No.
Not at Cornell.
Not at Cornell.
But during the summers you did.
During the summers I worked.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, along with other people who were not from New York State, would have had to pay tuition.
Yes. I think it was around $240 a semester.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider applying to the University of Pennsylvania?
No, I didn't.
And you lived in that room all 4 years?
No. I moved in with Bill Williams when Dick Gilliard graduated in 35, and I stayed in an apartment with him for 1 year, and then I moved up to OTS in my third year, and Norm Siebert and I roomed together for 2 years. Norm had a German Shepherd dog named Frau, and I was the only one she would let in that room.
You had a woman in your class, Marion Layton.
Marion Layton.
Yeah. According to the records that I found, she started in your class during her second year. I don't know where she was in the first year, or if my records aren't correct, perhaps. Do you know?
I thought she was with us in the first year.
Okay, I may be incorrect.
I thought she was with us.
She was from New York City?
Yes.
What was it like having a woman at that time? Because there were very few women prior to her. After her, there were more.
It was quite a bit of competition for her. I remember that. I can't say as we thought anything about it. You know, it was just like high school, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. The number of students from New York City in your class was quite high. Did you have any response to that? Did that affect you in any way? Because they were from the city, you were from the country?
No. There was animosity about them, yes.
In what respect?
Racial animosity. Mm-hmm. Most of them were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there being quite a bit of animosity about that.
From the students or from the professors?
No, from the students. That was back in the days before we were Christianized, or whatever you would call it. But
were there some that you knew well? For example, the Morris brothers?
I knew the Morris brothers well, yes. And they were a wonderful pair of guys.
Alexandra and Robert.
Twins. And Henry Grossman I knew very well. We all got along well, I think. But there was always that undercurrent of animosity, I thought. I don't think they were invited to join the fraternities, Alpha Psi or OTS.
The faculty, I'm going to look over some of the different courses you took and ask you about the different faculty, if I may. Before I do that, though, there were three men who were original faculty when the college was formed in 1896, who were still alive when you were a student. And they were Dr. Hopkins, Dr. Gage, and Dr. Williams. Dr. Gage taught histology, Dr. Williams was a large animal clinician, and Dr. Hopkins was an anatomist. Do you ever remember interacting with any of them?
I don't remember any of them. The names ring a bell, but I don't remember ever seeing any of them.
Well, anatomy you were taught by Dr. Sunderville, of course. What was he like?
He was a very matter-of-fact person. He wanted you to study your lesson and be prepared for it. He was an awfully nice man to study under. We all thought the world of him.
Did you know Mac Miller? He was in the class after you.
Yes.
But he was an instructor of anatomy in your class.
Yes, I did know Mac. Mm-hmm. And Mac went on and became professor of anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think wrote a book to replace Sisson's anatomy.
That could be Sisson and Grossman, perhaps. Physiology, you were taught by Dr. Dukes.
Dr. Dukes.
And people tell me he was a great teacher.
He was. A wonderful man.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember a man named Hayden? Not Dean Hagen, but Hayden, H-A-Y-D-E-N?
Yes, I do. And he taught, wasn't physiology.
Physiology as well.
Yeah. He was older than Dr. Dukes. But I well remember him. He was an awfully nice person.
And a young man named Dr. Batt. Henry Thomas Batt.
I remember him being there. I don't recall much about him.
You certainly remember Dr. Olofsson, Peter Olofsson.
Well, Peter Olofsson was... he was a great guy. We had a lot of fun about the way he marked us. And we all thought we were so smart in the beginning, and after when we got our results on the second prelim, we only got half a mark, in which none of us realized that it was, that's what it was. I thought it was a 40, but it actually was an 80. But he didn't tell us that.
But he expected a lot out of you.
As he said, in this course, 100% is the only thing we accept. You're taking pathology. You have to know what you're seeing.
As you look back, do you regard him as one of your finest professors?
Yes, I think I would. Yes, I definitely would.
Mm-hmm. What about Dean Hagen? Was he a good teacher?
Oh, wonderful. Dean Hagen was just another wonderful person in my life. He was the reason for one of the biggest changes in my life. When the war came along, he was put in the Bureau of Animal Industry as assistant to the chief. And when I was assigned to the Bureau of Animal Industry, he insisted I be sent to Connecticut because I was the only one who knew how to get around there. And so I spent the war in Connecticut and very close to home most of the time.
In large animal, you had Dr. Frost?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Dr. Danks?
Yes.
You do? Mm-hmm. What were they like?
He was, as I recall, a short man. He was a very intelligent instructor. Yes, we did post-mortem with him, as I recall. But he was a nice guy to work for.
That's Dr. Danks, you mean?
Dr. Danks.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Frost, he was a surgeon?
Dr. Frost was a wonderful horseman. Mm-hmm. And I always envied his ability to handle horses.
Henry Asmus, the farrier, did he work with Dr. Frost as well?
I remember him well.
Mm-hmm. How much of your work was with horseshoeing and farriery?
We had a course in horseshoeing in our first year. And I can't recall whether it was just one semester or two.
But it was important.
It was important.
And he had an assistant. Do you remember his assistant?
No, I don't. No.
In ambulatory, you had Dr.
Fincher.
Fincher.
Dr. Gibbons.
Dr. Gibbons was only at Cornell a short time, so you were one of the few people who had him. What was he like?
Very happy, friendly person. Mm-hmm. Used to be a joy to have the day on ambulatory with him, as he was always telling jokes, and he was a great guy. He went on to another university, I think.
I believe it was Auburn, but I'm not sure.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Udall?
Oh, yes. In medicine. Very staid. I was going to say severe, but it wasn't severe. But you didn't get any humor with Dr. Udall. He was all business.
Did you happen to know his son, who graduated 3 years after you?
I met him, yes, but I didn't know him well.
Did you have any interaction with the men in poultry, Dr. Bennett, Dr. Levine?
I don't think so. What did you say?
Poultry, chickens?
Poultry. No, Dr. Levine.
Dr. Levine?
Came after me, I think. Mm-hmm. And I remembered I was offered a fellowship out at the University of Illinois to study poultry in 1938. I think the fee was $650, the pay was $650.
But you decided not to go.
I didn't like chickens that much.
So
I once had a job working, killing chickens.
So then let's talk about what you did when you graduated in 38. You went to a small animal job first.
Yes, I did, to Rowley Memorial Hospital in Springfield, Massachusetts, for a month. And it was a great experience in small animals, because I had the hospital pretty much myself. I lived there. I spent 24 hours a day in small animal medicine. and it was wonderful.
Now, who had taught you small animal medicine and surgery at Cornell?
Dr. Milks and Dr. Stevenson. They were both the small animal, they ran the small animal clinic.
You told me earlier that you saw a cesarean on a bitch back in 1933. Could you describe that?
I recall it was Dr. A.T. Gilliard. A Boston Bull Terrier came into the office in the evening and was having trouble giving birth. He had his, I think it was his son, but I'm not sure, administer ether in an ether cone. And he did a midline incision, and I don't remember how many puppies, but I remember there were, and everything worked out fine, and the bitch was awake shortly after we took the ether away from her.
How did you get from small animal work at Raleigh down to New Jersey? What happened there?
Dr. Fincher, I couldn't think of his name. Dr. Fincher called me and said he had an opportunity he thought I should look into, which was to start the artificial insemination program in Sussex County, New Jersey. So I went back to Cornell. Dr. Fincher showed me the methodology of getting semen and injecting it into the uterus. And I went right on from there to Sussex, New Jersey, and went to work from the, I can't recall, Rutgers.
Rutgers Experimental Station?
Rutgers Experimental Farm.
Farm. And that's where they collected the semen? Did they collect the semen
that's
there?
We collected some of our semen, or most of our semen there. They had Jerseys, Holsteins, Guernseys, as I recall. And we processed the semen there. And then I went out on the road every day and injected whatever cows the farmers caught. They wanted bred that were in heat.
So you were in New Jersey for 2 years.
Two years.
Then what happened?
Then I was offered an office in Fairfield, Connecticut by an old friend. And so I went to Fairfield, and it was something I couldn't refuse, and I started in practice right away. Had a lot of cattle practice. I didn't do hardly any horse practice. And evenings, we do some small animal practice. And that lasted until the war started. And I was drafted by procurement and assignment into the Bureau of Animal Industry. And I spent the war in the Bureau of Animal Industry testing cattle for bangs and TB.
What happened to your practice when you were with the BAI?
The man who rented me the little store that I started in at for $35 a month said, I'm sorry, but I can't. I have to be paid to $35 a month. And the BAI was only giving me $37.50 a week, and I couldn't practice. So I had to give up the store. And I had a very good friend who offered me a home about a mile away on Greenfield Hill. And we moved everything up there. He had a tremendous barn on the place. I put all my equipment in his barn. And my wife ran a boarding kennel of sorts during the war while I was involved with the Bureau.
So you were married soon after you graduated?
Yes, I was married in 1939, mm-hmm. May 6th of 1939. Spent our honeymoon in Ithaca, New York.
Oh, my goodness.
That weekend.
And your two children came along when?
One was born in 41 and 46.
Mm-hmm. So after the war, then you went back to practice?
Not immediately. I was asked by the state of Connecticut to help them get their testing caught up. So I did nothing but TB and Bangs disease testing until I was hurt on June 14th, 1946. Walking through a field with a farmer, and suddenly a big Ayrshire cow attacked me. And I don't recall anything after that except ending up in the hospital with a broken neck and other injuries. And that was the end of my large animal practice.
You eventually ended up in small animal practice after that.
Yeah.
But it took you a while to recover from your injuries.
I was completely incapacitated, I remember, until Thanksgiving of 46. And then after Thanksgiving, they took the cast off and I was allowed to move around. And I helped with what we then had was a boarding kennel. My father built an office for me in the barn, so I started seeing small animals. I couldn't do much surgery, mostly vaccinating, and I think that was really about all we did, treating a sick dog, and that was it, boarding dogs. I remember even learning how to strip a wire fox terrier for show and how to cook poodles and do things like that. And I recovered from the accident by 1949. It was around then that I looked at myself and I'd gained about 40 pounds more than I was before it all started. And I had to do something, so I went back to riding. I rode every day, right after office hours at 1 o'clock every afternoon. Went up to the Fairfield Hunt Club. I had a horse there. Rode for an hour. Got myself back in condition. Practice improved and increased. And we did very well.
And you met somebody in dermatology.
Yes, I read about Dr. Kroll, who had come from Czechoslovakia to University of Pennsylvania as the world's only veterinary dermatologist. And so I had a very difficult case with a golden retriever, and I called him up and asked him if he would look at it. He gave me a date to come. And that's how I met Dr. Kroll, and I became very interested in his dermatology and took some classes of continuing education from him, and I found my practice changed very much to mostly dermatology, and I got referrals from all over after that. It was most interesting. Even had a call from an MD in New York City about a lady he had who had sarcoptic mange, excuse me. And it was all over her neck and her chest. And she had brought a little puppy from England back to New York by plane, and the puppy had slept on her chest on the way back. And she acquired sarcoptic mange, and this doctor in New York, whom I can't remember now, called me up and said, "How do you treat sarcoptic mange in a human?" And as I told him, you treat the symptoms, but you don't have to treat the mange because it's self-limiting and will disappear. And that was interesting, because she happened to be a rather famous person, and she did an awful lot of advertising for me from New York City. I used to get a lot of cases from New York City after that.
And you retired from practice, and when did you retire?
I retired in April of 1972, after having a surgeon who took a tumor out of my parotid salivary gland suggested to me that if I could retire, it would be a good time to retire. And it was for more reasons than that, too, because my wife had died at Christmas of 68. My father was sick with cancer. He died in March of that year, of 69. And I met Betty and married Betty in October of 69. We'd been friends for years. We'd both been in horses and horse shows, both been masters of foxhounds. And it just came suddenly. She came up to New York, or to Connecticut, from Florida, where she was living, for her daughter's wedding. And heard that Ruth had died, so she drove down from Waterbury to see me, and that was the beginning of a fine romance.
And she is still with you?
And she's still with me.
So she's had the privilege of being married to two veterinarians.
Yes, she has.
Mm-hmm. While you've been here in Florida, could you just finish up by talking a few minutes about your life here, both with horses and now in final retirement?
Well, we decided that we had too many goats in Connecticut, Betty and I. And we decided to, after they took my tumor out, to come to Florida, which we did. We each bought 40 acres of adjoining land. So we came to Ocala and bought a bulldozer. And I cleared a lot of the land and we fenced it. We did most of the work ourselves, which was a lot of fun. And 12 years later, we sold the farm to a neighbor. And then I really retired. And I've had a great time in Florida riding horses, raising horses, ponies, training dogs, obedience, tracking, agility. We've lived just a great life down here. We also became dancers. We did a lot of dancing. Ended up dancing at a silver level and traveled around the country dancing in different places. It was just great. But now I'm old and I can't do much.
You knew Steve Roberts, speaking about horses. He was a classmate.
Mm-hmm. Knew Steve very well. Rode with him almost every day. We used to leave the veterinary school at 4 o'clock, go over to the riding ball, and he'd practice his polo ponies, and I'd usually ride some of the officers' polo ponies to exercise them, and then there was a hunter jumper over there that I rode to exercise him, and we spent at least a couple hours over there every day.
Looking back at your life, you didn't become an engineer, you became a veterinarian. And you were happy about that, ultimately?
I'm extremely happy about becoming a veterinarian. I've had a wonderful, interesting life, full of opportunities. No matter what problem came along, something better always answered it. I just feel it was just a wonderful way to spend a lifetime. I realize now that I've lived a long time and I'm glad that I was able to do it.
Did you feel Cornell prepared you well for this life?
I thought I couldn't say more for Cornell. And Cornell prepared me completely for everything I've done.
Well, Dr. Draper, Andy, I thank you for the interview. It's been a pleasure to have this opportunity, and we'll record this in a way that I hope will be helpful to others.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Wonderful to meet you.